Okay, so it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker for workshop four. So Lucy Notes, I'm sure many of you know, is a social and cultural historian based at the University of Brighton. Lucy's research focuses on British experience and memory of warfare in the 20th century, with a particular emphasis on gender. Lucy published widely on the relationship between gender and the military in 20th century Britain. So this includes two monographs, one on war and the British gender and national identity, 1939 to 1991, and one entitled Women in the British Army, Women and the Gentle Sex, 1997 to 1948. Lucy is also a co-investigator of one of the recently established AHRC First World War coordinating centres. The centre that Lucy is the CI on is Gateway to the First World War, which provides support for community projects researching and commemorating the war at its centenary. And this morning, Lucy's paper is entitled Eve in Khaki, Feminine and Military Identities in the First World War.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm going to stand up so that you can all hear me and so that I can reach across the PowerPoint easily as well. Is my PowerPoint on? Sorry, bear with me. Okay, great. So, can you see it? Is it here? Because I've got lots of pictures, but I think they're a bit kind of fuzzy anyway, so the best chance possible to see them. Okay, so in 1917, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, the WACS, was formed. And famously, this is the first time that a modern nation state had authorised and recognised women's military or quasi-military service. Dressed in khaki uniforms, the members of the WAC performed a range of duties behind the lines of the Western Front and in the military camps at home, where in fact most of them were based, that were perceived as necessary to the successful prosecution of this first modern total war. However, I want to argue, feminine identities had to be preserved alongside military duties, and the very presence of women in military uniform was often controversial and unpopular. So in this paper, I'm going to trace some of the debates around women's military service in the First World War in both official and unofficial capacities, and I'm going to argue that claims to the right to wear khaki by many women and the concurrent desire by many to preserve khaki as the signifier of a competent man formed a lesser known but still significant battle in the midst of the First World War. So in December 1914, new evidence of the khaki fever that swept Britain in the early months of the First World War began to be seen on the streets of British towns and some cities. The Women's Volunteer Reserve, the WVR, a voluntary organisation formed in response to the shelling of Hartlepool, Scarborough and other towns on the north and east coast of England by the German fleet, although initially welcomed, soon became the subject of virulent and sustained criticism in the press. Widely seen there as a female encroachment on the masculine activity of fighting wars, the WVR literally embodied for some the worst aspects of the suffrage movement's espousal of the war effort, or the majority of the suffrage movement's espousal of the war effort, I should say, being no more than an excuse for women to dress as men and generally, and I quote, assume mannish attitudes. Now, I'll return to the debate about the WVR later in the paper, but I want to begin by considering why they were so controversial. What was it about them that so riled members of both the press and the public? So here's a quick photo of them. Okay. Yeah, there we are. This has come from a really good website, Wolverhampton at War, a WordPress website, and it's, I don't know what you call them, the platoon of the WVR, and I hope it's a little bit grainy because it came originally from a newspaper. But I hope that you can make out, we'll see some better images later, but the fairly kind of military sort of aspect, I guess, of their uniforms, in particular the double-breasted jackets, which were very controversial. So while some units of the WVR did practice drill and train with rifles, they insisted on military nomenclature and language. For the most part, their activities fell comfortably within an established but contested sphere of feminine influence in wartime, caring for the sick, the elderly, the frightened and the injured in cases of aerial attack or invasion, which was expected early in the war, and assisting male soldiers through training in camp cooking and first aid.
But I want to suggest it was the fact they wore khaki while undertaking these activities that both caught the eye and disturbed the delicate gender balance in the war that in some ways acted to strengthen an already naturalised divide between men and women through the recruitment and then the conscription of men to the military services. But in others, through the movement of women into munitions and other war work, through the necessity of women undertaking roles in the domestic sphere that had previously been understood as the preserve of men, and through the eventual creation of women's auxiliary military services, threatened to destabilise gender roles. In a country slowly awakening to the fact that it was engaged in a very different sort of war to any seen, at least in Europe, beforehand, khaki was an important means of both symbolising the difference between fighting man and those he was told he was going to war to protect, and increasingly as a symbol of the sacrifice of these men, a sacrifice seen as materially separate from that made by workers and families on the home front. So in this paper, then, I want to trace some of the ways that the gendered meanings of khaki challenged and fought over during the war and in the immediate post-war period. So I'll be approaching this very much as a social and cultural historian, not as a historian of fashion or design or material culture. So I'm going to focus on the kind of the what I call the lived and symbolic meanings of the colour, rather than the circumstances and means of its production. I'm going to begin by outlining some of the discourse that emerged around khaki in this period, before going on to examine, firstly, the usage of this particularly symbolic colour and the debates that grew up around this by the WVR, before considering the creation of the first official state-sponsored women's khaki organisation, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps that I mentioned at the start, in 1917. And then finally, I'll just very briefly look at what happened to these feminine uniforms at the war's end. So Jane Tynan has written on the evolving meanings of khaki for the fighting man in early 20th century Britain. Khaki had first been adopted by the British Army in 1902, and it was adopted in, firstly out in the, you know, kind of policing the colonies, but also in response to the evolving kind of higher accuracy in weaponry, and that made low visibility on the battlefield increasingly important. While differences of military rank remained largely shaped by social class, khaki nonetheless acted to an extent as a social leveller, in which the common masculinity of the men wearing the military uniform in some cases superseded or was seen as superseding differences of class. Tynan quotes Michael McDonough's 1935 memoir of life on the home front, London during the Great War. I've got an image which is not of the kind of the hotels that I'm going to read the quote out about. Quite difficult to see, but I've really put this up partly because I like it so much. But it's a YMCA canteen at London Bridge. The YMCA ran canteens at all the big London stations that soldiers came in and out of on their way to and from the Western Front. And I like it because, I don't know how clearly you can see it, but the range of uniforms, women's and men's, that are on display, and the way that the men in the background form a kind of sea of khaki. So McDonough says, what was new in this spectacle was the number of young fellows in khaki scattered among girls in brightly coloured frocks and elderly men in the black and white of evening wear. Strangely enough, most of the soldiers, so far as I could see, were not officers but privates. Khaki, he says, has obliterated the differences in class which are so apparent in civilian time. Now, I think he's exaggerating, but that's kind of an interesting point. As the war continued, many of the remaining distinguishing features of the uniform that separated officers from privates were discarded, as it was found that shiny riding boots, breeches and leather puttees made junior officers who served on the front line conspicuous targets for snipers. And his secret is soon modelling the early officer's uniform for us here. And I think you can see that the riding breeches and the swagger stick. And you can just about see the white puttees at the bottom that they used to wear. It did make them easily sort of picked off. So this at least partial visual erasure of class, as they got rid of these kind of determining factors from uniform, occasioned by the ubiquitous nature of khaki on the home front as well as the fighting front during the war, London of course being only a short journey by train and by boat of a few hours from the base camps near the coast in northern France and Belgium, was perhaps seen most clearly in the lists of the missing and the dead that appeared with monotonous regularity in British newspapers, the names listed there, of course, being repeated on the many thousands of war memorials to these young men that were constructed in the 1920s, And in these, and here's a slightly grainy example of one here, where this is from the Daily Mirror in 1916. I imagine it's towards the end of the Battle of the Somme, it's October. So you've got eight men who were missing, all but one, this one, who was a lieutenant corporal, I think, are wearing military uniforms, and are kind of unified both by their missing status and also by their uniform. And it's also interesting because you can see addresses. You can't see, actually, but I took my word for it. Each of these have addresses and parents usually listed beneath them. So this kind of the image of the dead and the missing men in their khaki with their addresses and a kind of a plea for any information become a key linkage in what Jay Winter has termed the fictive kinships that emerged among the bereaved during and after the war. So khaki then came to symbolise both military service and a specifically masculine form of patriotism, seen, for example, in the imagined romantic future that you can see in this recruiting poster, which is aimed at women. Is your better boy wearing khaki? If not, don't you think he should be? If your young man, it continues, neglects his duty to king and country, the time may come when he will neglect you. And in the advice that I found in the Evening Standard from August 1914, so right at the outbreak of war, that its female readers should, and I quote, cut the acquaintance of your sweetheart unless he wears khaki and shows he deserves the name of a man. So this linkage between a particular form of masculinity and khaki starts to appear really early on. Men who were not seen in khaki were sometimes offered petticoats, a symbol of a domesticated and kind of passive femininity, an impractical femininity, the antithesis to the active masculinity that was symbolised by the wearing of khaki. So khaki then became swiftly linked with male heroism, male patriotism and male service in wartime. Women's role in relation to the khaki uniform was firstly to ensure that the men of their family and social circle were wearing it, and later, as the production of military uniforms came under the control of the War Office, to make them in the factories and mills of Northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Ultimately, though, the khaki uniform stood as a symbol of a common male sacrifice. Although the original aim of the adoption of khaki by the British Army had been to render its wearer inconspicuous on the battlefield, away from battle it made his membership of the military in wartime visible. And it became, I think, a kind of visual signifier of what was increasingly becoming the only acceptable form of masculinity for young, able-bodied men. When these men died, often with their bodies being lost on the battlefield, the khaki of the uniform, the destroyed body, and the mud of Flanders literally becoming one, as here in Charles Nevinson's famous and sensitive 1918 painting, Paths of Glory. It was painted for a Royal Academy exhibition. It was accepted, and then it was one of the very few paintings that were censored during the war. So they still displayed it, but it had a great big censored sort of banner that went across the middle. It was an official War Office, which was really interesting. So the memorials that commemorated them, if figurative, represented them in the khaki uniform of the living soldier. At the unveiling of the war memorial in the West Yorkshire mill town of Batley, for example, General Sir Ian Hamilton's speech reminded those present that the men went forth into battle, the women wove khaki, and miles of khaki cloth poured out of Batley's, and the fighting men wore it, fought in it, died in it, and were buried in it. So you can see a very clear kind of gender dichotomy there, and some of the ways that the idea of sacrifice is being attached to the idea of kind of wearing, fighting, dying and being buried in khaki for men. But sculptural memorials like this were kind of atypical. The most common memorial was a cross of remembrance and a roll of honour. But occasionally, figurative memorials included the figure of a woman alongside or in place of the khaki-clad man. And such figures were usually mothers, seen here at this, I like which one, this memorial at St Anne's, Lancashire, of the woman. She's kind of not being very maternal, is she really? So she's got the baby, you know, climbing up, but she is so overwhelmed by grief that her arms are just kind of hanging by her side. Or this really unusual one, Port Sunlight, put Cheshire, it's Squirrel, I think that's Cheshire. And I don't know how clearly you can see this, but you've got the two very active male soldiers. You've got the one dead or dying male soldier resting his head on his comrade's arm, and behind, you've got the woman sheltering both behind the still living soldiers,
behind the memorial which symbolises, you know, the kind of the war of the dead and sacrifice of men. And what unfortunately what you can't see from this photo is kind of clinging to her skirts as a small child.
So women have a particular role in these still existing kind of material reminders of the First World War that are all over Britain. So as has been noted by many scholars, figurative war memorials acted to re-embody, to remember the disembodied lost dead, whose bodies, when they were recovered, were usually buried in cemeteries close to where they fell, remaining in many important ways the property of the state that had sent them away to war. And this was very controversial at the end of the war, the 1920s, the decision to keep all the bodies close to where they fell. And this emphasis on the uniquely masculine nature of khaki, however, shouldn't blind us to the wide range and nature of uniforms that could be seen in Britain in the early years of the war. In an increasingly militarised society, uniforms could appear ubiquitous, worn not only by servicemen, but by factory workers, transport workers, boy scouts, girl guides, nurses and canteen staff. Uniforms had a strong appeal for many women alongside men, the wearing of uniforms symbolising that one was willing to, and I quote, put away the fripperies of peacetime and to dedicate oneself to the war effort. Indeed, the appeal of the uniform was reflected in changes in women's fashion during the war. Again, I'm sorry, this is kind of hard to see, but sand green weatherproofs, these are adverts for raincoats that you see in lots of different newspapers by about 1917. And what's interesting is both the design, which kind of mirrors the greatcoat that men were wearing really to keep kind of warm and dry, or to attempt to keep warm and dry, on the Western Front. But what you can't see is they all have names like the Flanders, the Major, the General. Okay, and they're being put forward here as well as being fashionable, as well as practical. So there are changes in women's fashion during the war. And these change to reflect both women's wartime work in a whole range of areas and the changes that this often very physical work and the high carbohydrate diets of wartime were making to women's bodies. Women are basically becoming kind of stockier and stronger. Perhaps, though, the strongest linkage in the early days of the war, before the full impact of this first 20th century total war was felt fully on the home front, between women and uniforms, was the highly codified and performative clothing that had been utilised by the Women's Social and Political Union in the immediate pre-war years, the main suffragette organisation. Hats, badges, brooches, scarves, sashes and banners in the WSP used colours of white for purity, purple for the royal blood of the suffragettes and green for hope, had become a well-known sight on the streets of British towns and cities as the suffrage campaign reached its militant height just before the war. While the WSPU, under the leadership of Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst, abandoned the suffrage campaign for the duration of the war. So I was reading on the train down yesterday, I was reading a collection of letters by Vera Brittain, one of which she goes off to Cologne in 1934 to report on Hitler giving a speech, and she rather cattily, she's trying to describe Hitler's sort of oratory style to her readers back home in Britain, and rather cattily she says the closest that she could come was Emmeline Pankhurst. It made me laugh on the train. So while the WSPU abandoned the suffrage campaign for the duration of the war, throwing themselves instead into recruiting rallies and other patriotic activities, very visible, again, a kind of theatre of recruitment going on, it appears the pre-war organisation had self-consciously utilised notions of battle and of a male military heroism. And Sylvia Pankhurst, the estranged daughter of Emmeline, recalled in 1931 how the spirit of the WSPU now became, she's talking of just before the war, became more and more that of a voluntary army at war. Processions and pageantry were a prominent feature of the work, and these, in their precision, their regalia, their marshals and captains, had a decidedly military flavour. Flora Drummond, pictured here, was called the General, and she rode at the head of processions with an officer's cap and epaulettes, which you can see here, and it's really interesting, a kind of combination of the very feminine Edwardian blouse, and then the officer's cap and the attempt at kind of militarisation that represents. So as the WSPU had actively represented their suffrage campaign as a war, for example, by issuing medals to women who'd gone on hunger strike when in prison, it was perhaps little surprise that for many,
women's voluntary embrace of military uniforms and paramilitary activities appeared as a form of encroachment upon men's supposedly natural relationship with militarism, one that perhaps had the unspoken aim of ensuring female enfranchisement through war service. Although individual women were sometimes allowed to embrace masculine notions of Flora, of feminine heroism, so there's a couple of years ago, Flora Sanders, who was well known, she went off and she fought, she became an officer in the Serbian army, and then she kind of made her living in the years after the First World War by going around still dressed in her Serbian officer's uniform, giving talks about it and writing books about it. So Flora Sanders, you know, individuals are allowed. Flora Sanders, the other ones who were kind of allowed were the Angels of Pervaise, so that's Marie Chisholm and Elsie Knocker, who drove their motorbike around close to the front line, collected injured soldiers, took them back and nursed them. So they're the kind of obvious examples. But widely reported but never verified sightings, and I think it's never happened. I got all excited when I found this in the newspapers, but I think it was just a kind of, you know, imaginary thing. So sightings of a quote, a battalion of suffragettes arriving on the Western Front in February 1915, ready to do, and again I quote, their Amazonian best to help the men fighting there, were largely kind of reported with rather voyeuristic approval. Uniformed organisations of women, like the WVR, who appear to be encroaching on masculine territory, were the subject of widespread debate and criticism. And the WVR were just one of many voluntary women's organisations that sprung up in the early days of the war, as upper and middle class women, keen to be seen to be doing their bit, often, it appears, drawing on organisational experience they developed in the suffrage campaign, formed themselves into a whole range of institutions. The Times listed 12 London-based organisations on the 31st of August 1914, so 4 weeks after the war has started. These include the Women's Emergency Corps, the Women's Suffrage National Aid Corps, and Queen Mary's Needlework Guild. And the Women's Volunteer Reserve grew out of the Women's Emergency Corps, itself formed by prominent members of the WSPU. And the Women's Emergency Corps undertook a whole range of different activities, primarily helping Belgian refugees. So while these activities were largely seen as indicative of women's praiseworthy desire to perform an active role in the war effort, to demonstrate that they were no less patriotic than the men who were signing up in their thousands for military service, as it became increasingly apparent the war wasn't going to be over by Christmas, public support for some of these activities began to wane. And the WVR were perhaps unfortunate in that they were formed soon after the first rocket battle of the Marne in September 1914, and that's the point at which the war stops being kind of war of movement, becomes the war of attrition, the lines of troops dug into the trenches that offer some protection from the new, more accurate shell fire facing each other across no man's land. And by this, from this point on, it's become apparent that the war is no longer going to be a short-lived opportunity for adventure, and attempts or perceived attempts by women to treat it as such were less likely to be indulged. Although their formation was largely welcomed in the press, by mid-1915, following the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, and in the midst of the ongoing losses at Gallipoli, public opinion turned against women, who were widely perceived as taking advantage of war conditions to further their own selfish aims. The stated aim of the WVR was to provide a body of disciplined women who'd be able to serve civilians and military alike by undertaking a range of tasks which included signalling, crowd control, first aid, camp cooking and driving. Their uniform drew heavily on the existing model of male military uniforms. Khaki with fitted double-breasted jacket with large pockets, shirt and tie, a slouch hat and often utilising a leather Sam Brown belt. The only obvious concession to the gender of its wearers being the full skirt, and some members of the WVR preferred to kind of mirror what we saw Siegfried Sassoon wearing earlier with the riding jumpers, absolutely more practical. As I said at the beginning of the paper, it was their appropriation of khaki uniform with all its significance as a symbol of male service and sacrifice, as much as some of their activities, that provoked much of the criticism of the organisation. As women were not being asked to make the ultimate sacrifice of fighting and dying for their country, of course many did die alongside children and male civilians in air raids, in accidents at work, and then in the flu pandemic at the end of the war that's so linked to the movement of peoples and the conditions probably on the Western Front. Their usage of khaki could not have the same meaning as when it was worn by men. Khaki was, and I think still is to a large extent, a highly gendered colour. One letter writer to the weekly paper The Globe expressed it like this. He said, "Khaki is sacred to our men for whom it forms a shroud. It's the garb of the fighting man who goes out risking life and limb for England, home, and his womankind, and should not be lightly donned." The intimation here that women were trespassing on male territory perhaps suggests something of the underlying insecurity around the gender roles that were being constructed. If women wearing khaki destabilised the masculinity of the men who were wearing it in such large numbers, then perhaps this masculinity and the gender binary that underpinned it were not very secure. As Marjorie Garber has argued, the sight of women wearing orders of medals pinned to their chests suggests that such orders can be unpinned, detached from men. And this gendered anxiety spilt over into the letter pages of newspapers and magazines, in particular the Conservative Morning Post, where members of the WVR were accused of, I quote, "masquerading in khaki uniforms," another quote, "aping the bearing of soldiers," and "playing at being soldiers." These women, the letter writers argued, needed to realise that, and I quote, "they never can be soldiers, and all the drill and marching in the world will never make soldiers of them." This is the point made visually in this 1916 Punch cartoon, which I find quite funny. So as well as trying to destabilise the relationship between masculinity and militarism, the donning of a khaki uniform by women was seen as undermining the femininity of those who chose to wear it. Charles Dawbourn, writing in the Evening News, affected to see something distasteful in the short-cropped hair and the mannish stride he perceived women in khaki adopting, claiming that, however excellent her service, they would be nonetheless so if she'd adopted more feminine garments. A letter to the Morning Post claimed that the uniform only makes them look ridiculous, while the Daily Mail, showing a remarkable continuity in its attitudes towards women, stated that a section of them have earned the title "it." Neither men, as they could never claim the ultimate distinguishing feature of that gender in wartime, which is to fight and die for one's country, nor in their adoption of khaki and so-called mannish attitudes, any longer visibly women. Dressed in khaki, but not performing the full range of duties demanded of the male combatant, to their critics, they both undermined their claim to femininity and the symbolism of the military uniform. Women could never be soldiers, but by wearing a soldier's uniform, neither could they be truly feminine. The WVR, though, remained a popular organisation. It continued to recruit and to mobilise large numbers of middle and upper class women. You had to pay to join, so it's very kind of class based, who desired some more active means of participating in the war effort than knitting socks offered, but who were unwilling or unable, perhaps, to fully devote their lives to this in the ways that Vera Brittain and her fellow VADs did. Members and organisers of the WVR fought back against their attackers in the press, claiming, somewhat unbelievably, that khaki had only been chosen for its practical, not its symbolic qualities, as it was, and I quote, "the least likely to show dirt." An article in the Midland County Express, and the WVR is very popular in the Midlands, particularly around Birmingham, stated the use of khaki had been a practical, not a symbolic response to the need to wear a kit in which it's easy to move around. And they also attempted to distinguish themselves from other smaller voluntary organisations that also made great use of uniforms, and to align the WVR with the male military services. And they published a guide called How to Recognise Our Devoted Women that derided female slackers who only don khaki, and I quote, "to look smart and military and mannish when they're doing no military service at all." Finally, and perhaps to an extent this could be understood as something as a kind of a retreat, they emphasised the feminine nature of the WVR, claiming there's nothing unfeminine about the Women's Volunteer Reserve. On the contrary, it's a distinctly womanly movement. As the work of rendering aid and guidance to the aged, infirm, panic-stricken and helpless who can do nothing for themselves was a simple extension of women's established caring role. By 1917, it was becoming increasingly clear that the formation of women's work was a military, the formalisation, sorry, of women's work was a military was going to be necessary in order to enact the thorough comb out of men who'd previously served behind the lines that was demanded by Lieutenant H.M. Lawson's report into military manpower, which was carried out really during the Battle of the Somme, with its very high casualty rates, and was published in January 1917. In response, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps was formed. It was formed by the War Office, working with prominent women such as Lady Londonderry, who'd formed the Women's Legion in 1915, and it's formed in March 1917. While the army wanted to make use of women's labour behind the lines, debates within the War Office display high levels of concern that the gender divide between these women, who would undertake work that released men for combat duty, and the combatant man, and also the non-combatant man, the many men who remained in duties behind the lines, be preserved. And one way this, they attempted to achieve this was through uniform. So as khaki uniforms were the key visual signifier of male service and sacrifice, much discussion took place regarding the provision of uniforms for the WAP. Early debates questioned the necessity of providing uniforms of any sort for the auxiliary women. And this is a quote from one of the many minute meetings in the War Office. So an unnamed civil servant says, 3,000 women now at work at home have done without it. Why should we incur the expense of uniforming them now? Women can work just as well in garments of other hue and texture, provided as hitherto at their own expense. And Lawson's initial report had recognised difficulties that were likely to come into play around the use of khaki as the colour for the WAP, and he suggested perhaps, and I quote, there could be some advantage in having the uniform in some colour other than khaki, possibly blue. Eventually, the military men and civil servants of the War Office agreed that women would, I'll come back to this in a minute, would wear a uniform. Those decisions seem to have less to do with a need to build an esprit de corps, which is what women on various committees have been arguing for, than a desire to provide uniforms as a way of preventing, and I quote, unauthorised females entering camp areas. Remember this place where the Contagious Diseases Act is brought back in around some camps. Now, this I found this on the web, and it's been listed on the web as a WAC uniform. To me, it looks really like a WVR uniform. But I think actually the very early, I don't know if anybody over here might be able to help me afterwards, but I think the very early WAC uniforms were very much based on existing WAC uniforms. They change later on. I'll show you a later example. They become more feminine later on in the war. Where was I? Okay, so other symbols of military identity were carefully policed, none more so than the issuing of military badges as markers of rank for the WAC. Now, Helen Gwynne Vaughan, the very formidable corps commander in France, she goes on to form the ATS at the beginning of the Second World War, had insisted on badges of rank and on a military salute in the army, in the military. If you see people saluting somebody, they're not saluting the person, they're saluting the rank, so you salute a senior rank. So she'd insisted on badges and salutes in France. And this caused, as you can imagine, some consternation in the War Office, because it meant that theoretically a non-commissioned man on his way to the front line would have to salute a female auxiliary officer behind the line who remained legally a civilian. These women were auxiliary. They never actually came under full military authority. They were legally still civilians. But she was wearing a badge of rank higher than his, and therefore he'd have to salute her. This caused all sorts of anxiety. So the War Office insists this would not do. Gwynne Vaughan insists on badges as a means of differentiating between her women. And eventually they reach a compromise, which I don't think she liked very much, which was that women would wear badges of rank on their sleeves. But unlike the army's stars and bars, these were going to be flowers. The rose and the fleur-de-lis, I can't remember what they both signified. So the official nature of the WAC and the recognition that women's labour was needed in the military as well as in the civilian sphere of war made it difficult for newspapers, which have so often been critical of women in uniform, to know quite how to represent this new group of women in khaki. Did they emphasise their femininity as a means of continuing to differentiate them from the serving men and preserving gendered identities, or did they emphasise their military role? And in so doing, perhaps aid recruitment among women who were keen to find a more visible and active way of participating in the war effort. And the answer was, of course, that they did both. An early recruitment advert in the Daily Express here calls for women to be... this isn't the advert, this is a recruitment poster. An early recruitment advert, and I'll come back to this, calls for Amazonian auxiliaries, while an approving article in the Evening Standard described khaki girls for whom The rules, written and unwritten, include injunctions to abjure powder for the face, to put hats on straight, and not at the coquettish ankle, and not to smoke in the passages of the barracks. So if you like to be as kind of militarised as possible, which I think you can see in this very early recruitment poster, where A, they're women, unlike the poster I showed you at the moment, it emphasises the kind of work that they'll do, and one of the things that it highlights is uniform. Okay, some actually have good wages, uniform. Other representations downplayed the military nature of the Corps and emphasised instead their femininity, particularly in the later stages of the war. The novelist Hilda M. Love, writing for the Daily Mail, described a very feminine soldier, and I quote, "Her tip-tilted nose just showed over the turned-up collar of her greatcoat. The night wind loosened a side curl which she tucked beneath her chin strap." So the impression given here is of a fragile yet determined femininity, a gender that's emphasised by the contrast between her embodied and kind of fragile femininity and the masculine nature of the uniform that she wears. Likewise, the authors of a short book published in 1918 called Eve in Khaki, in response to a drop in recruitment, which in itself was a response to both persistent rumours that circulated that said that the real reason women were being sent to France was to be sexual partners for the soldiers, and higher rate, probably more importantly, higher rates of pay that were available in munitions factories. So this book, Eve in Khaki, compared the feminine women of the official organisation favourably with the volunteers of the WVR who had preceded them. And they said, "At first, it must be confessed, we had a swaggering type of khaki-clad girl. Her hat tilted at an acute angle and held by a chin strap. Her regimentals complete with brass buttons and badges, and a mannish assurance that was by no means an attractive quality. The work has developed into a very attractive little person in her neat frock coat, brown shoes, garter and gloves. The khaki woman has proved her womanliness and worth over and over again." And this book comes out around about the same time as this later recruitment poster, which actually was Queen Mary's Army Auxiliary Corps, renamed in an attempt to boost recruitment. Which, you know, she's not a woman anymore, she's a girl, and she's behind the man, behind the gun, and you can see the changed uniform. This is like this little private's uniform here, which the white, you know, fairly impractical, given the work that lots of them are doing. White collar, which, you know, reflects light back onto your face, and a tight belt, much more feminine. I mean, a lot of you will know this much better than me, but much more kind of feminine cut of what she's wearing. And that poster, she almost looks like a kind of milkmaid to me in that poster, I think. Maybe it's the yellow. So the transition from the WVR, playing at soldiers, to the serious and unselfish nature of work with the WAC was personified in Eve in Khaki through the story of Betty, who's described as a pretty, petite and precocious young person who had begun to sit up and take notice when a new genus, a khaki girl, arose, and who is now one of the most dependable workers in the Women's Army, and it carries on. The Sam Brown belt and breeches have long disappeared into limbo. Okay, so she's dropped playing a soldier and become a real, not a real soldier, but a real auxiliary support worker. In the propaganda around the WAC then, we can see an attempt to feminise khaki, to contrast the WAC's use of it with those of voluntary organisations, to represent the wearing of the khaki uniform by women as a feminine equivalent of the service and sacrifice of the combatant man that she's there supporting and behind. One that perhaps, because it was undertaken in response to a national call, could be understood as an appropriately feminine form of service. So in the last 18 months of the war then, we can see an attempt to create a khaki uniform for women that could contain both their feminine and their military identities. Unlike the self-designed uniform of the WVR, the uniform of the WAC was designed to be feminine enough, distinct enough from that worn by military men, not to provide a challenge to the gendered identities so important for continuities of wartime Britain. Nonetheless, the appearance of women in khaki continued to be contentious, and it wasn't until 8 young female members of the WAC were killed in an air raid at Etarpe military camp in northern France in the German push of Easter 1918, being buried with full military honours, that criticism of the Corps and rumours about their alleged impropriety began to die down. Khaki and femininity, even when endorsed by the state, was a potent and often problematic mixture. The antipathy and distrust of women's motivations for joining the Auxiliary Corps and donning the uniforms that continued to circulate came to the fore again on the war's end. Despite calls for the continuation of the corps by its female leaders, it was disbanded in 1921, the last act of the members in France being to care for the body of the unknown soldier while he kind of lay in rest in northern France, and then to accompany him on his journey to Westminster Abbey, kind of appropriately feminine, nurturing role. And also they looked after the war graves. Shortly after the war ended, newspapers began to print articles emphasising the incompatibility of khaki and femininity. An article in the Sheffield Daily Telegraph claimed that women who'd served in WAC, and I quote, show a tendency to avoid the homes and sever their home ties, attempting to appear hard and masculine, and leading the author to hope that they will shed their army manners with their army uniforms. A writer for the Saturday Review feared that khaki had spoiled women for their domestic role, claiming in an article called Back to the Home that since a large part of the female population have had the time of their lives swaggering about in every kind of uniform, there was a danger in peacetime they'd be unwilling to return to being wives and mothers now the men are coming home. And the Times was even more unequivocal, simply stating, to be frank, the public has grown tired of uniformed women. Attempts by Lady Londonderry to create a corps of domestic workers who would wear a blue uniform, they'd live in hostels, they'd maintain the officer structure of the WAC, came to nothing, unsurprisingly, as the appeal of uniform for women, many of whom had actually been employed in domestic duties in the auxiliary corps, didn't carry over into the increasingly unpopular realm of domestic service in peacetime. Women who'd worn khaki in wartime had been walking a tightrope then. On the one hand, donning this particular colour was a means of expressing their patriotism and visually signalling that they too were doing their bit. On the other hand, they were widely seen as taking advantage of the turbulent times, encroaching on the male sphere and sullying the sacred nature of the khaki uniform to the combatant man. While a society in total war wanted to see some evidence that women were contributing to the war effort, it also didn't want femininity to become too uniform. Most importantly, women were not to ape men, they were not to lose their femininity. One of the things men are told they're fighting for is, you know, the maintenance of the home. Women in khaki were widely seen as both a necessary aspect of the war effort and concurrently as a threat to male military morale. The khaki uniform was a highly complex gendered symbol signifying courage, service and sacrifice when worn by young men, but having a much wider range of meanings when worn by women, and these varied from patriotism and duty to frivolity, selfishness and promiscuity. Despite the attempts by women to claim that wearing a khaki uniform rendered them equal in patriotism to men, the meanings that khaki conferred on its wearer were shaped by the gendered body beneath it and not simply by its colour. Thank you.